Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. This is the full moon night. With today, this is the last day of the official rainy season, and also the last day of the year 2552. This is New Year's Eve, this evening, in terms of the Buddhist calendar. And also I'm reminded that, if I'm remembering correctly, it was on this same full moon night during the Buddha's lifetime, the full moon, a month after the ending of the rains retreat, was when he, one year, gave the Anapanasati Sutta, a discourse on the mindfulness of breathing. And as the beginning of the Anapanasati Sutta, he describes how the Buddha was so impressed after the rains retreat had finished by the depth of practice and the usefulness of people's efforts during that time, that he stayed on for an extra a month at the monastery where they were all living together. And and then at the end of that month, on the full moon night of Komudi, the full moon of the white lotus, this the end of the Katika month, the last month of the rainy season, then the Buddha on that occasion gave the teaching on mindfulness of breathing, Anapanasati. Last week I was offering some reflections about the nature of spiritual life, or the use of the word spirituality, and how that's related to the breath, from the Latin spiritus, and how that principle of breathing, on a biological level, is has become associated and related to, synonymous with, the source of life on an internal level. In terms of the religious or the most profound psychological level of our lives. And then it's interesting how in particular in the Anapanasati Sutta, this teaching, how the Buddha also relates the connection between the breath, Pana in Pali, or Prana in Sanskrit, how the breath is also connected with the profoundest elements of our being, and also the process of realization. The first part of the Anapanasati Sutta, it goes through in great detail the different elements of mindfulness of breathing, concentration on breathing. The process of mindfulness of breathing, the Buddha aligns very much with the development of the foundations of mindfulness. And as I was reflecting last week, how that verse from the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, mindfulness is the path to the deathless, heedlessness is the path to death. The mindful never die, the heedless are as if dead already. This is verse, I think verse 20, 21 of the Dhammapada. And in that verse, and he's pointing out how if we're mindful, then we're truly alive. But if we're not mindful, then it's as if we're dead already. And he says the mindful never die. That doesn't mean that if you're mindful, your body won't stop breathing. But it means that when there is mindfulness, when there is that true heedful quality, then we're truly alive. That there is a genuine attunement to reality. And if there's heedlessness, if there is no attention to the way things are, if the mind is filled with greed, hatred, delusion, then we're lost. It's as if we're dead already. The body might be breathing, but we're basically just dead meat, dead in the water. We're as if we're not alive. We're not fully with the living, not truly in living accord with reality. So that same principle is spelled out in interesting ways in the Anapanasati Sutta. And this was a very long and intricate discourse the Buddha gave on that full moon night. And it begins with tying the quality of concentration on the breath to the four foundations of mindfulness. Because we might think, well, just mindfulness of breathing, it's just the air goes in, the air goes out, you follow it. Just go keep your mind on one spot and you just track the air entering and leaving the body. Oxygen in, carbon dioxide out. Just the body breathes, it's a simple feeling. Just pay attention to that. What's there to say? You know, no big thing. But if you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, you know, it's extremely extensive and very intricate and thorough in its own way. And each of the stages of it are allied to the foundations of mindfulness. So for each of the four foundations, each of the Satipatthanas, then there are four subsections. So for mindfulness of the body, that has four sections to it. Then mindfulness of feeling, that has four sections. Cittanupassana, the mindfulness of the citta or mind states. Again, that has four sections to it. And then the last one also, Dhammanupassana, mindfulness of dhammas, or the investigation of dhammas, or seeing things in terms of, you can translate Dhammanupassana as mind objects, contemplation of mind objects, or contemplation of things in terms of dhamma. And as the Buddha says a few times during the course of the sutta, then the mindfulness of breathing is very helpful for developing the four foundations of mindfulness. It's a major and powerful support for cultivating the four foundations of mindfulness, so that we might think with a cursory glance that mindfulness of breathing is just a simple one-dimensional thing, but as it's pointed out in his teaching, there's many, many aspects to it. And so the first part, mindfulness of breathing, is just in terms of what the body's doing, just the air entering and leaving the body, and the quality of attention being paid simply to that physiological process, the inhalation, exhalation, and in terms of the physical quality, the physicality of breathing. So that the breathing process we can see through the framework, as Ajahn Tanisro calls it, the foundations of mindfulness he renders as the four frames of reference. So we use that frame of reference as the body, so we can contemplate the body in terms of the breath, and the feeling of the breath, the actuality of the air entering and leaving the body. So we're contemplating our own form, the kaya, the physical body, through the agency, through the framework of what the breath is doing, how the breath is connected and is part of the physical process. Then the second section is Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feeling. So the different sensations that go along with the rhythm of the breath. So contemplating or developing the foundation of mindfulness of feeling, Vedana Nupassana, through the feeling aspects of the breath, the subtle and coarse sensations that go along with the movement of the breath, and as the breath enters and leaves the body, so that one's exploring the realm of feeling through the activity of the breath. And then the third foundation, Cittanupassana, is a lot to do with mood. So in the Satipatthana Sutra itself, the teachings on the foundations of mindfulness, and the Buddha highlights Cittanupassana in terms of such things as saying, knowing the expanded mind is expanded, knowing the contracted mind is contracted, knowing the angry mind is angry, knowing the mind free of anger as being free from anger, knowing the agitated mind is being agitated, knowing the mind free of agitation as being free of agitation. So that it's a lot to do with mood, knowing what the mood of the mind is. And so using the, similarly we can use the breath to track those qualities of the mind states as it, and it's also to do just as with the other aspects of the breath and in the contemplation of feeling or contemplation of the body. It's always conducing towards focus, towards concentration, towards calmness, and so that in this third foundation, the Buddha talks about things like stilling the thought formation, the vitakka sankhara santanam, stilling the thought formation. So that's like calming that process whereby the habits of thinking get activated, get agitated and sort of mobilized into being. And then in the last of the foundations, this fourth foundation of mindfulness, what the Buddha focuses on is simply the way that we can develop insight. We're seeing things in terms of Dhamma through the activity of the breath. So particularly just the rising and passing of phenomena, that quality of anicca. So it's a lot to do with developing anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence through the impermanent quality of the breathing. That simple changingness of the breath is what is focused upon to help support seeing things in terms of Dhamma, seeing things in the in terms of their fundamental actuality of their nature, that the that things are made up of the patterns of changing experiences, patterns of nature coming and going and changing, formulating, disintegrating incessantly. So Dhammanupassana, sometimes it's rendered as, translated as mindfulness of mind objects, it seems particularly clearly in this, as it's described in the Anapanasati Sutta, mindfulness of breathing discourse, that when the Buddha's talking about how do you develop Dhammanupassana, with the breath, it's the impermanent quality, the changing quality of the breath, the arising and ceasing, that very fluid wave-like pattern. That's what is being looked at. It's the changing nature of the breath that is the key faculty, the key factor that is is being focused on, and is directly related to the development of wisdom. It's through that understanding and the apprehension, the apperception of the quality of change, of transiency, that the faculty of wisdom, of panya, is aroused, that's initiated or entrained, ignited through that, the cultivation of the insight, watching the process of impermanence, recognizing that quality of impermanence within the breath. That's the focus, focal point of the breath, or the characteristic of the breath that is being registered. This is what makes it Dhamma Anupassana. So as the Buddha says many times in a sutta, that contemplation of the breath, mindfulness of breathing, leads to and supports the development of the four foundations of mindfulness. And then in the similar way, then the four foundations of mindfulness lead to the development of the seven factors of enlightenment. And he spells out how it is that then with the four foundations of mindfulness being established and made firm and steady, that supports the very directly the quality of the seven factors of enlightenment. Because mindfulness, sati, is the very first of those seven factors. And then mindfulness of the breath and the quality of mindfulness being established, and then leads to investigation, as I said, that leads to the development of that investigative wisdom, that exploratory quality. It leads to the attribute of understanding. So if sati is the first of the seven factors of enlightenment, then Dhamma Vijaya is the second. Investigation, Dhamma Vijaya literally means investigation of reality, or exploring the reality, exploring the Dhamma, investigation of Dhamma. Then when the mind explores examines the way things are, this gives rise to energy, virya. That's the third of the seven factors of enlightenment. That arouses the quality of energy and the capacity to engage, the brightness of the mind, the basic arousal level of the mind. And when the mind is aroused and bright, energetic, then this leads to piti, or rapture, joy, and which is the fourth factor of enlightenment, the fourth of the bhojangas. Then when there's rapture, when there's piti, then this leads in turn to pasadhi, which is tranquility, calmness. There's a settling of the mind that comes when there's a quality of joyfulness, when there's that brightness, then everything's all right. And there's a basis for a contentment and a profound happiness, a joyfulness that's there. So this leads on to pasadhi, which is the fifth factor of enlightenment. And then that leads to and conduces to concentration. When there is that quality of tranquility, the mind is bright, is energetic, is alert. Then it's focused. The samadhi, or the quality of attention, centered on a fixed object, is established very easily. Samadhi means literally something like correct holding or appropriate holding. The mind easily holds an object, holds the present moment. And the last of the seven factors is that of upekha, equanimity. The mood that arises the overriding attitude or disposition, the feeling tone, the mood tone of the heart and mind when the seven factors of enlightenment are developed, is that of equanimity. So in that particular instance, the Buddha talks about these seven factors of enlightenment as sort of one arising from the one before, because of A, then B, because of B, then C, because of C, then D, and so on. But also, they don't have to be seen in a sequential way. It's not just like with the Eightfold Path. You can see at them. You can look upon them as a progressive sequence. Yeah, right view leads to right intention. Right intention leads to factor 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on. Yeah. But you can also see them as coexistent, as simultaneous and mutually supportive factors. So in that way, rather than just thinking, oh well, when there's mindfulness, then that leads to Dhammavijaya. But also you can see how when the mind is really focused, when there's a true quality of mindfulness, when the mind is freed from any kind of attachment or entanglement, then all those seven qualities are there at the same time. It's just they don't sort of have to argue for space with each other. They're all, in a way, similar. They're attributes of the pure heart that coexist. I mean, you can define each attribute, but they're all basically there simultaneously. When the heart is free from clinging, then it's mindful. There's a natural intelligence and pattern recognizing quality. It's recognizing the way that things work. There's energy. It's joyful. It's calm, focused, and equanimous. You know, all of those can be there together. They're not like arguing with each other. So that just as a glass of water, water can be both. You can talk about the color of the water, the fluidity of the water, the temperature of the water, the viscosity of the water, the stillness of the water, and so forth, or the agitation of it. That they're all qualities that you can define, that the temperature is not the same as the viscosity, but they're all just different attributes of the same glass of water. They're just different parts of it or different qualities that are being talked about. So in this way, just focusing on the breath, just the simple entering and leaving of oxygen and carbon dioxide, nitrogen going into the body, coming out of the body, then as the Buddha spells out, this leads to the development of mindfulness in all its dimensions. It leads to this source of life on a spiritual level, on the quality of true life. You know, mindfulness is a path to the deathless, that simply following the breath helps us to awaken to the deathless, to that which is truly and totally alive. And that manifests in the form of the seven factors of enlightenment. So mindfulness of breathing leads to the development of the four foundations of mindfulness. The four foundations of mindfulness lead to the seven factors of enlightenment. And then finally, he says, when the seven factors of enlightenment are developed, when they are fully cultivated, and then with each one, if mindfulness is as a factor of enlightenment is fully developed and cultivated, then this leads to viveka, viraga, nirodha, vosagga. These lead to viveka, seclusion, or a quality of restraint or retreat. Viveka, containment maybe is a good word for viveka. Viveka, viraga, dispassion. that which is away from the raga, from the that which is away from the rage, was not raging. Viveka, viraga, nirodha, cessation, the ending of dukkha, the quieting, the quelling, quenching of dukkha, and vosagga. Vosagga means relinquishment or abandonment. So, and this is an interesting collection of qualities. Viveka, viraga, nirodha, vosagga. Because when we think about developing mindfulness of breathing, getting concentration, or developing the factors of enlightenment, we can use that kind of language. It can seem like when we're getting concentrated, we're getting more accomplishments, we're getting more skills, we're getting more of these different spiritual qualities. And it can be subtly forming itself into an acquisitive process. Me getting more spiritual, me getting more awakened, me getting. But there's this very thoroughly emphasized tone that is there. So when each of these qualities, when all of the seven factors of enlightenment are really brought to their fulfillment, their completion, what does that lead to? That leads to seclusion, dispassion, cessation, relinquishment. That's all the all completely about not getting, not having, not being, not holding, not being entangled. So this is a very helpful signal, isn't it? It gives us a very powerful clue. It's not about getting. It's not about becoming. It's not about me being something. It's about letting go. It's about relinquishment. It's about non-entanglement. That's, in a way, a beautiful characterization of that tone of the practice. It's about non-accumulation, non-proliferation, nipapancha. It's about not non-possession. As the Buddha said in the verses of the Suttanipata to Kappa, the Brahmin, about Nibbana as the island that you cannot go beyond. It's a place of no thingness. It's a place of non-possession. That is why I call it Nibbana. Now, when we think of things in terms of our spiritual life, or developing our spirituality in terms of an accumulation or of a getting, or me becoming something, me becoming spiritual, or me getting enlightened, me getting insight, then even though those are just figures of speech, they can lead to sort of unhelpful, acquisitive attitude, and continuing to unconsciously support that self, the quality of self-view, and the habit of becoming. And when we hear such language as cessation, relinquishment, non-possession, it can be off-putting, or it can seem forbidding or unattractive, unappealing. So it's useful to contemplate language and the effect of language, and how we're conditioned by language in that way. How just the possibility of nibbana, the possibility of cessation or non-possession or relinquishment, that why is it that might seem off-putting? Why might that seem something that's unappealing or unattractive? And if we reflect on our conditioning, reflect on the language that we use, and you can see how much that getting and having and being and becoming has a tendency in our society to carry the attributions of goodness, of fulfillment. You know, and not just here in the West, also in, say, in China, the images of fulfillment are the great fat-bellied Maitreya with sort of huge bulbous stomach billowing out, and lots of little offspring, you know, clambering around his knees and over his shoulders. This is the image of abundance. Fulfillment is the big belly, and so this is an archetype or a mythic form that is around, that influences us, and just the way that we language things. But these are just the conventions of language, are not something that we so have to be governed by. So it's useful to investigate that. Why does, if that's the case, that we find it off-putting, it's good to pick that up. Use that power of Dhamma Vijaya to investigate. Why is it that the idea of non-possession or relinquishment is off-putting? Why does cessation seem like something that is indicating a quality of loss or lack, a state of incompletion or sorrow? Why is that? Where does that come from? Why would the Buddha equate this with this highest happiness? If Nibbana is the highest happiness, then how come it's associated with dispassion, with cessation, with relinquishment? How does that happen? How does that work? Oh, looking at the quality of language and our conditioning is very helpful in this way, because you might think, well, in the first part of the sutta, then it looks very sort of bright and encouraging and inspiring, and then the words there at the end can seem a little bit chilling or strange, like, why should that be so special or good? So we look at that. What does this mean? Why might the feeling of relinquishment, abandonment, why might that be indicative of a total happiness? What's that pointing to? How could that work? Viveka, seclusion or a containment, that quality of withdrawal, withdrawing. Wouldn't that mean loneliness? Wouldn't that mean that some sort of separation from the loved, from the familiar? Why should that be synonymous with such a great happiness? Why should that be an attribute of a spiritual perfection? Why should it be that way? So looking at the conventions of language, the conventions of thought, can be really helpful to see, well, where's the conditioning coming from? If that's the kind of trigger, if that's the effect that those kind of words have, those non-words, that seem to make Nibbana off-putting, where does that come from? What's the conditioning? What are the conventions that we're habituated to? Just like at the beginning of the evening saying, oh, today's New Year's Eve. Yeah, well, not to me it isn't. Well, maybe in terms of the Buddhist calendar, but who pays any attention to that? This isn't the real New Year's Eve. Yeah, we all know that the real New Year's Eve is January 31st. Sorry, December 31st, January 1st. You know, that's the real New Year. But it's just an agreement, isn't it? Before the current use of the Julian calendar, then it was the winter solstice was the eve of the new year. December 21st, that was when the year changed. Then for various reasons, the calendar got tweaked a few times and then drifted to December 31st, January 1st as the New Year's Eve, New Year. It's just a convention, isn't it? You just decide it's going to be, that's the new year. Every so often they've had to put in extra day when they tried to, I think it was establishing the Julian calendar, changing over from the Gregorian. Then they realized they needed to add an extra 5 days to get the calendar to add up to what the year was doing. And it threw people out. There was riots in the streets. People, what? Where did these 5 days come from? Did God create these, or did He not? Or what? What's happening? How can they suddenly create extra time? They're tacking in those extra days between the year as they knew it and the new realigned calendar, or just like changing the clocks. Okay, now daylight savings is over. Now we're back on Pacific Standard Time. We're under PST. We all agree. Okay, at 2 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, yesterday, it stayed 2 o'clock in the morning for an hour. It's the clock stopped and it was 2 a.m. for an hour. Huh? Yeah. How many of us in our misspent youth found ourselves in the middle of one of those nights, up at 2 a.m. on a late Saturday night, trying to make sense in our befuddled states of suddenly losing an extra hour or gaining an extra hour? How could it possibly be 2 a.m. for an hour, or going straight from 2 a.m. to 3 a.m. with no 2:30 and anything else in between? Just suddenly, whoop. It's an hour different. But it's a convention, isn't it? It's just a human agreement. We just all decide, okay, are we ready? 1, 2, 3, click. And we all change it. Just, we all agree it's this, and then thus it is. It's like, apparently the monks at Mount Tabor don't observe daylight saving time, so that whole part of the year, they carry on with their own standard time, because they don't agree with daylight saving as a principle, so they just carry on with their hours as a completely different time zone from the rest of California. It's the Mount Tabor time that carries on. Or like Tanjali Pala would say about Indiana, that where they don't use daylight saving times, that it's always 1949 in Indiana. When the daylight saving started to be introduced, that Indiana said, nope, we don't like it, we don't do that, it's not going to happen here, not in our state. So it's always, he's from Indiana, so he has the right to malign his own state. It's always 1949 in Indiana. Now, these things condition us, the agreements that we grow up with in our our nationality or our particular disposition here. But we don't notice how strong those qualities of conditioning can be, even when they're just arbitrary agreements. We get familiar with the system, we become a faithful party member, and then we buy into that, the systems, and they become imbued with that sense of reality, and then we go along with them, we believe in them. But so often that those ideas or those principles, those terms, that we forget that the strength or the quality, the tone that they've got is something that we've ascribed to them. We've given them that meaning. We've given them that value. And on their own, they don't have that value. As Ajahn Chah would say over and over again, the things of the world are just conventions of our own creation. And having established them, we get lost in them, giving a rise to trouble and confusion. We create daylight saving. We create New Year, or the Buddhist New Year. Yeah. Okay. In terms of our calendar, tomorrow 2553 begins. Yeah, this is the last day of 2552. Sri Lankan calendar, it's not 2552 at all. It's already been 25. This is the end of 2553. They're a year different. The Burmese are different in a different way. the Chinese Buddhist calendar, again, it's a different year. Japanese Buddhist calendar, it's a different year too. Jewish calendar is 5,700 and something. Yeah. What year is it? What day is it? What's that? What's the real number? Yeah, and as far as the planet's concerned, it's utterly indifferent to what the humans are calling it. It's just doing its thing, rolling around the sun, not counting the numbers, not making anything out of the number of times it spins. This is our creation. So we determine things into existence and then are affected by those things that have been created, have been decided upon. They don't have any self-existent quality. I remember when I first arrived at Wat Pa Nanachat in northeast Thailand, I wandered into the monastery in early January of 78. I'd never been to a Buddhist place before. I'd stayed overnight in other monasteries just as a cheap place to stay. But I'd never really had any contact with Buddhist teachings, never read a Buddhist book, never met any people who were practicing Buddhists that I had spent any time with. But I had a very strong feeling from the first few days I was there that this was something that was, it was very interesting and was a perfect situation for me to stay in. So I had a feeling I was going to stay for a long time. And I was very enthusiastic and interested, the keenness I experienced being there. So I had this feeling I was going to be around for a long time. But also I realized I don't have a clue about any of these things. And I don't know, you know, anything about Buddhism. I don't know anything about the Buddhist teachings. And so I had this very strong feeling in those first few days, right, that this was a really important moment. And I have a recollection of this of insight arising. Like, you don't know anything whatsoever about Buddhism. You don't know anything. But if you stick around here within a short time, you're going to get very familiar with all of the whole slew of ins and outs and ups and downs and rights and wrongs that you have no clue about right now. So you have the chance to watch a world come into being. And it was true. I remember, I've often told the story of how after I'd been there about 3 or 4 months, we were cleaning the shrine the day before the observance day, like today. It's the observance day, so the day before we'd have cleanup, as we do here, we did in Thailand. And we were dusting the Buddha images on the shrine, and I said, it's really interesting, isn't it? It's strange how in all these Buddha images, he looks kind of Indian. Yeah, and the monk I was cleaning the shrine together with said, well, it's not really that surprising because he was actually Indian. I said, no, he wasn't. He was from China. Everybody knows that. Buddha was Chinese. And he gave me this look like, no. The Buddha was from northern India, actually born in Nepal in the Himalayan foothills and then spent his whole life wandering the Ganges Valley in northeast India. I said, no, he wasn't. He's Chinese. Everyone knows the Buddha was Chinese. So I went back, and I was always very happily prepared to be an authority on something I didn't even have much of a clue about, but I was always convinced of my own rightness. And so, anyway, we went back and forth a few times until finally he was able to convince me through not just his own arguments, but also just showing me in Buddhist history books. Look, born in Lumbini, northern India, lived in northern India. Oh, look at that, amazing. And I'd been there for 3 or 4 months, happily believing that the Buddha was Chinese. Yeah, I'd never even heard of Theravada or Mahayana Buddhism. And then someone made some sort of comment about Theravada. And I said, well, what's that? And they said, well, you are one. I said, what? I said, you're a Theravada. We're a Theravada monastery. I said, what is that? What do you mean I am that? How can I be a Theravadan and not know what that is? And so they said, Theravada. So this is in Thailand, this is a Theravada Buddhist country. It means the way of the elders. So this is the oldest original tradition of Buddhism. And then the northern countries like China and Japan, Tibet, they're Mahayana Buddhists. What's that? Well, Mahayana, they got different scriptures and, you know, different teachings of the Buddha. So then Mahayana, that means great vehicle. Oh, really? What's that? So they're giving me a whole sort of explanation. And so I've been in the monastery again for a few weeks or months before I heard this. And then, so not having any kind of loading about small vehicle, great vehicle, you know, which vehicle one might have climbed into, or which one was better. And then in that same way, I saw that as I listened to these sort of explanations, or saying, yeah, well, they call us small, inferior, kind of crummy vehicle, but actually we're best. We're the oldest and we're the best and we're real, and they're a bunch of fakes. They made up all their own scriptures and they just kind of invented things and put them into the Buddha's mouth, but you know, we're the real thing. Oh, right, yeah, right, that's us. Yay, team, yeah, Theravada, that's us. We're right and good, and they're all bad and stupid and wrong. Right, yeah, that's it. And you know, and feeling the sense of allegiance to the, you know, the Theravada team and the Arahant path, the A team, and then there's the B team, the Bodhisattva B team. Like they're the other lot, and how we're right and they're wrong. But in the background, as these things sort of took shape, I remember that clear insight that I'd had during the first week or so, where it says, you know, you're going to watch a world come into being. And I thought, oh yeah, that's right. Because 6 months ago, I'd never even heard of Theravada or Mahayana. Didn't have any meaning to me. I didn't know about, you know, Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Mahabur or Ajahn Buddhadasa or you know, Ajahn Tate. And I never even heard these names. But now I've got this set of values that, you know, Ajahn Chah is like this and he's really great. And yeah, Ajahn Buddhadasa, he's like this. And Ajahn Mahabur, he's like that. And, well, this whole value system has just sprung out of nowhere, and then now I've got all these allegiances worked out, and this value system, and this is good, and that's bad, and this is right, and that's wrong. You see, well, this is just the shape of the world as it's come into being in the Theravada Buddhist domain of Wat Phananachat here in the late 70s. There's a bunch of us living here together, and this is our world, this is our conditioning. We use this kind of jargon around the monastery, a sort of mixture of Thai and Pali and English sort of slang words to communicate with each other, that 6 months ago I hadn't got a clue what these things meant, and now that these words, these strange syllables roll off my tongue, and they mean things. But 6 months ago they didn't mean anything. Saying one pra. One pra, what the heck's a one pra? One what? What's a two pra? Is there a two pra? Do you get two pras or three pras? No, one. It's not one as in one. It's one as in one, the day. It's not as in one as opposed to two. Oh, it's not just one pra. Okay, sorry, I didn't quite understand that. And then it becomes a normal phrase. It just rolls off the tongue, and you know it means the day when it's a half moon or a full moon or a new moon. So this is a really helpful thing to contemplate, that we determine our perspective on the world into being. It doesn't have an existence on its own. We create it. We take these words and these collections of syllables, and we imbue them with meaning and value, and then they affect us. Suddenly you're supporting one group and you're criticizing another. You're cheering for this team and sneering at the other. That you're looking forward to one pra because the day after you might get peanut butter and toast for breakfast. Suddenly, this is a conversation we were having at tea time today, suddenly the words one pra mean, ooh, peanut butter and toast in the morning. Whereas 6 months ago, the word one pra would mean, one what? Wouldn't mean anything. It's just a nonsense word if you're not familiar with Thai language. And when we take the trouble to contemplate our conditioning and see this is a world that's come into being, and we're able to then measure what's come into being against a baseline. We've got a background to measure it against, a baseline to measure it from. So we can see that our particular judgments or the way that certain words affect us is just a habitual pattern. It's not something that's substantial or real. And so then that gives us a very direct way of investigating it, of looking at it and say, well, what's that pointing to? What's that coming from? How does that work? What's this referring to? So that we're not just blindly going along with the impressions that certain words give us, but we're taking that and exploring it, yeah? Examining it and finding out for ourselves and seeing what these things lead to. What their real essential quality beyond the word, beyond the nomenclature that we use, so that we're not just reacting blindly to the triggers of, you know, what we've been conditioned to. We're not just like a Pavlovian dog that just blindly jumps when you say Theravada, yay, Mahayana, boo. Or Ajahn Chah, yay! Ajahn Mahabua, boo! Yeah. Or Christianity, ooh! Buddhism, yay! Yeah. We're not just like a blind reactionary force in the universe, but we're able to see the way that words affect us, and we're able to look into that and to explore. What is that? Relinquishment. Why is relinquishment synonymous with perfect spiritual beauty and the highest happiness? Why is seclusion or withdrawal, why is that synonymous with freedom, with happiness? Being passionless, viraga, dispassionate. How is not being passionate about things synonymous with happiness? Why is that indicating the great perfection, spiritual perfection? Nirodha, cessation. How can that indicate something that is ultimately good, ultimately pure, totally liberating? How does that work? What is that? Why is, if it's off-putting, why is the cessation bland or uninspiring or leaving us just with a sense of nebulousness? So what? Something ceases. Big deal. Why should the Buddha use that to point to something that is so ultimately important, significant? Where does that come from? So in that Anapanasati Sutta, this is a wonderful and enormously comprehensive teaching, but it's extraordinarily helpful. It goes from the very nitty-gritty and practicalities of developing mindfulness of the breath through the development of the factors of enlightenment to these characteristics of the liberated heart. And pointing the intrinsic connection between them, and how this simple quality of the biology of the body and its respiration, how paying attention to that, just simply drawing the mind, bringing the mind to that, can lead all the way to this most profound transcendent realization, the true fulfillment of our of spiritual potential and that quality of freedom and stability of insight, of purity and stability and clarity of insight. It leads all the way to that, to the fulfillment of that spiritual life, to the point where we are able to be truly alive, truly awake, to embody the deathless, to not just to know it, not just to understand it, but to be that deathless element as well. So that on this full moon night, the full moon of Kumudi, I believe in the Pali calendar, the White Lotus, month of the White Lotus. This is a lovely opportunity for us to practice meditation together, developing mindfulness of breathing and all those attendant qualities that can arise from that. This is a great and beautiful occasion. The weather is glorious. The skies are clear. So the night is before us, and may we use it skillfully. Amen.